When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Good morrow, Stuarts and handmaidens, red priestesses and secret Targaryens, and welcome to another Still Smug Book Talk. As ever, it's your valorous knight, Sir Duncan the Fearsome, vanquisher of shadow demons and lord of Castle Stirling. Today, we'll be covering Game of Thrones Season 7, Episode 3, The Queen's Justice, from a book reader's perspective, examining crossover material, book nods, and new information that may inform mysteries that the book readers have long speculated about. There will be numerous book spoilers ahead, so if you don't want to have events and information from the A Song of Ice and Fire book series revealed to you, now is your chance to spin the knob. That being said, show watchers of a more wild-eyed and information-hungry nature who don't mind book spoilers are welcome to join us. I'll try to discuss and explain things in a way that non-book readers can follow along to, and maybe you guys can even gain some cool insight or context to the show based on the book information. Spoilers in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Clocking in at 63 minutes, The Queen's Justice was the longest episode this season so far, and it was a joy to experience. For 21 years since George R.R. Martin's A Game of Thrones was released, readers have been wondering how Gurm, the master of weaver of tales, would manage to steer Jon and Dany, two characters who started off on opposite ends of Planet Os, in two seemingly unrelated storylines, into the same plot and location. And it's finally happened, if on screen rather than on page. Things are really starting to go down on Game of Thrones, and I'm really loving the 7th season thus far. Our first book crossover is Tyrion's method of infiltrating Casterly Rock, which had echoes of the method allegedly used by the only other person to ever take Casterly Rock. That person, of course, is the legendary Lan the Clever, founder of House Lannister. Lan, Lannister, you get it. So for those who didn't know this, Casterly Rock, before being occupied by the Lannisters, was owned by House Casterly. The World of Ice and Fire reads, "Though never kings, the Casterlys became the richest lords in all of Westeros and the greatest power in the Westerlands, and remained so for hundreds of years. By then, the Dawn Age had given way to the Age of Heroes. That was when the golden-haired rogue called Lan the Clever appeared from out of the east. Some say he was an Andal adventurer from across the Narrow Sea, though this was millennia before the coming of the Andals to Westeros. Regardless of his origins, the tales agree that somehow Lan the Clever winkled the Casterlys out of their rock and took it for his own. The precise method by which he accomplished this remains a matter of conjecture. In the most common version of the tale, Lan discovered a secret way inside the rock, a cleft so narrow that he had to strip off his clothes and coat himself with butter in order to squeeze through. Once inside, however, he began to work his mischief, whispering threats in the ears of sleeping Casterlys, howling from the darkness like a demon, stealing treasures from one brother to plant in the bedchamber of another, rigging sundry snares and deadfalls. By such methods, he set the Casterlys at odds with one another and convinced them that the rock was haunted by some fell creature that would never let them live in peace. Lan the Clever supposedly lived to the age of 312 and sired 100 bold sons and 100 lissom daughters, all of fair face, clean of limb, and blessed with hair, quote, as golden as the sun, unquote. But such tales aside, the histories suggest that the early Lannisters were fertile as well as fair, for many names began to appear in the chronicles, and within a few generations, Lan's descendants had grown so numerous that even Casterly Rock could not contain all of them. Rather than tunnel out new passages in the stone, some sons and daughters from lesser branches of the house left to make their homes in a village a scant mile away. The land was fertile, the sea teemed with fish, and the site they had chosen had an excellent natural harbor. Soon enough, the village grew into a town, then a city, Lannisport. So, the way that Tyrion snuck into the rock with the Unsullied through his secret little passage and a cleft in the rock, which he had engineered during his time as a master of drains and sewers, perfectly mirrors the way that Lan the Clever allegedly infiltrated the rock way back in the day at the founding of House Lannister. Our next book crossover is Cersei and her parallels to the Mad King Aerys II. We saw Cersei this week forcing family members to watch each other die, just as the Mad King did. In Cersei's case, she had Ellaria and Tyene chained up in the black cells and poisoned Tyene, forcing Ellaria to watch her die and then rot away. In the Mad King's case, he had Brandon Stark captive after he rode south to challenge Rhaegar to free Lyanna. And then he called Rickard Stark to come down to the south to basically answer for his son's crimes. Rickard demanded a trial by combat. Aerys chose fire to be his champion. He's basically strung up Rickard and set a fire beneath him and roasted him alive in his metal armor. Put Brandon Stark's sword just out of reach, hooked him up to a device he obtained from Myr, which strangled Brandon to death as he struggled to reach the sword. So there's one clear parallel between Cersei and the Mad King. The next is Cersei's sexual arousal after murdering Tyene. After her poisonous kiss, we then see Cersei find Jaime. She's basically super horny and will not take no for an answer. She forces herself upon Jaime, who does stop resisting pretty quickly. But it could be significant that he was vocally uninterested to begin with. This scene draws eerie parallels to a disturbing scene from the books involving the Mad King Aerys. We learn about it in A Feast for Crows in Jaime's second chapter as he reflects on Cersei burning the Tower of the Hand. Jaime knew the look in his sister's eyes. He had seen it before, most recently on the night of Tommen's wedding when she burned the Tower of the Hand. The green light of the wildfire had bathed the faces of the watchers, so they looked like nothing so much as rotting corpses, a pack of gleeful ghouls. But some of the corpses were prettier than others. Even in the baleful glow, Cersei had been beautiful to look upon. She had stood with one hand on her breast, her lips parted, her green eyes shining. "She's crying," Jaime had realized, but whether it was from grief or ecstasy, he could not have said. The sight had filled him with disquiet, reminding him of Aerys Targaryen and the way a burning would arouse him. A king has no secrets from his Kingsguard. Relations between Aerys and his queen had been strained during the last years of his reign. They slept apart and did their best to avoid each other during the waking hours. But whenever Aerys gave a man to the flames, Queen Rhaella would have a visitor in the night. The day he burned his mace and dagger hand, Jaime and John Derry had stood at guard outside her bedchamber whilst the king took his pleasure. "You're hurting me," they had heard Rhaella cry through the oaken door. "You're hurting me." In some queer way, that had been worse than Lord Chelstead's screaming. "We're sworn to protect her as well," Jaime had finally been driven to say. "We are," Derry allowed, "but not from him." Jaime had only seen Rhaella once after that, the morning of the day she left for Dragonstone. The queen had been cloaked and hooded as she climbed inside the royal wheelhouse that would take her down Aegon's high hill to the waiting ship, but he heard her maids whispering after she was gone. They said the queen looked as if some beast had savaged her, clawing at her thighs and chewing on her breasts. A crowned beast, Jaime knew. So there are definitely some disturbing parallels going on here between Cersei and the Mad King. Cersei seems well on track to becoming the Mad Queen. And the fact that Jaime had initially refused Cersei's advances leads us to our next book crossover. Jaime falling out of love with Cersei. So in the books, at this point, Jaime is certainly in a different headspace than he is on the TV show, but we're starting to see it creep in on the show. Him refusing Cersei in that moment, and then his reactions as Olenna before she dies by poison, the way that she talks about Cersei to Jaime, saying that she's a plague or a disease, that she's a horrible person, and she's going to bring Jaime down with her. It's all hinting to the idea that Jaime is going to fall out of love with Cersei, which is exactly what seems to be happening in the books as part of his redemption arc. You know, Jaime starts off as such a terrible person, pushing a little kid out a window and whatnot, and slowly we learn that he's actually an honorable man in his own way. in the bathhouse scene with Brienne, he tells her about how he saved King's Landing from the wildfire attacks of Mad Ares, and his rejection of the maniac Cersei is sort of another element that is redemptive to Jaime's character and pushes him along a path of honor. Other factors in his redemptive arc are the fact that he gives Brienne of Tarth the sword made from Ned's dark sword Ice, Oathkeeper, and encourages her to fulfill her oath to Catelyn Stark. And then the way that Jaime diplomatically handles other situations with honor also leads towards his redemptive arc as well. Another little cool book crossover was when Dany tells Jon about his ancestor Torrhen Stark bending the knee to Aegon the Conqueror. As you guys know, I mentioned that a few weeks ago, and I posted on our Game of Microphones page some information about Torrhen Stark and where this happened and how it's significant to the story nowadays. But basically, Torrhen Stark was the king in the north at the time of Aegon's conquest, and after seeing the way that Harren the Black was defeated in the field at the Fields of Fire, and the way Harrenhal was melted by dragons, Torrhen Stark basically decided to save his people, the Northmen, by bending the knee to Aegon the Conqueror. He lost a kingship, but his people survived to fight another day. And at the place where this infamous knee bending occurred, today there stands an inn known as the Inn of the Kneeling Man, which is on the Red Fork of the Trident River, which is along the Southern Fork, basically. Our next cool book crossovers are the parallels between Jon Snow and Rhaegar Targaryen. We learned from Barristan Selmy a couple seasons back that Rhaegar never liked killing, but he loved singing. And we learned this episode that Jon Snow does not like doing what he does best, which is probably killing and fighting and warring in general. But book readers know from more information, various quotes about Rhaegar, that he was kind of a melancholy dude, sort of like Jon, and that he was more into reading books than he was into fighting when he was younger. He was obsessed with the prince that was promised prophecy and eventually became a warrior because he felt like he needed to as part of this prophecy. But we know a good amount about Jon at this point, and there's a pretty good record of the kind of person that Rhaegar was. Jorah Mormont describes him, saying, "Rhaegar fought valiantly, Rhaegar fought nobly, Rhaegar fought honorably, and Rhaegar died." So there's Jorah saying that Rhaegar was valiant, noble, and honorable. Those are all traits that we know very well Jon Snow possesses as well. Even Cersei Lannister compliments Rhaegar repeatedly, saying, "Had any man ever been so beautiful?" Which is funny because who was it? Tormund that says that Jon is prettier than any of his daughters. So there's another parallel there. Even the Honorable Ned Stark, whose sister Rhaegar allegedly and in popular opinion had kidnapped and raped, even throughout all the Ned Stark chapters in A Game of Thrones, Ned never has a negative thought about Rhaegar. At one point, there's a quote from the book that says, "For the first time in years, he found himself remembering Rhaegar Targaryen. He wondered if Rhaegar had frequented brothels. Somehow, he thought not." Another parallel with Jon, who we learn at one point refuses to go to brothels and partake with the joys to be found there, because as a bastard, he doesn't want to subject any future child to having that style of life. He doesn't want to create any more snows. It's an honorable trait in Jon that apparently seems to mirror Rhaegar, his father. So we're starting to see a lot of parallels forming between Jon and Rhaegar, and little hints everywhere that Jon is in fact a Targaryen. As they're walking up the ramp, bridge, walkway thing to Dragonstone, Jon says, "I'm not a Stark." And right then, a dragon flies overhead, hinting at his Targaryen lineage. Daenerys also says at one point that she's the last Targaryen, but we all know that's not true because Jon's in the same room. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how it ends up being revealed to Jon that he's a Targaryen. Bran had said that he had to talk to Jon when he was talking with Sansa, and Jon was mentioned. And the fact that he's with Mira Reed provides another element of solidifying the truth to John. He could tell John that he's a Targaryen, and John might not believe it, or there's room for debate. But if Mira Reed's father, Howland Reed, shows up at some point and testifies that he was at the Tower of Joy, he knows that Lyanna is John's mother and that Rhaegar was his father, that could carry some serious weight. People even speculate that learning this may really upset John, that he could turn against Ned Stark, mad that he lied to him for his entire life about his heritage. It could turn John dark side. We could see John becoming the bad guy here, which would be pretty interesting dynamic change for the TV show. Here's a cool quote from an article I found that highlights another parallel between John and Rhaegar. As one Redditor spotted, the first came from John's hype man, Sir Davos, who told Daenerys that John has gained support from the North not for his name or lineage, but for the devotion and faith he's inspired in others. Quote, "All those hard sons of bitches chose him as their leader because they believe in him," Davos says. That line sounds a lot like a piece of dialogue Sir Barristan Selmy once said about Rhaegar Targaryen back in Season 3 when consulting Dany about purchasing the Unsullied. Quote, "When your brother Rhaegar led his army into battle at the Trident," Selmy says in Season 3, Episode 3, "men died for him because they believed in him, because they loved him." So Rhaegar and Jon seem like pretty similar guys, really. They're both loved and respected. They're both honorable. They're both melancholy and brooding. It's pretty cool. It's going to be fun to see this play out and to see Jon's reaction and Daenerys' reaction when she learns that Jon is her nephew. Looking forward to this season very much. Our next cool book crossover are hints to a popular book theory, which is the Bran is all Brandon's theory. Basically, there's a pretty popular theory out there that somehow, due to his connection with the Weirwood trees, that Bran Stark is actually all the Brandon Starks that have ever been. That Bran built the wall back in the day, that he built Winterfell, built Storm's End, that he was Brandon the burner, the guy who burned all the ships, and Brandon the Builder, and that he is all these guys. That he somehow is traveling through time through the Weirwood network and existing in all these different time periods simultaneously and separately, and however you want to think about that in all its confusing glory. So during this episode, Bran told Sansa that he is the Three-Eyed Raven. And then he also tells her that the Three-Eyed Raven taught him everything he knows. And she says, "I thought you were the Three-Eyed Raven." He says, "I told you, it's difficult to explain." Well, if it's just a title that's passed down from one Three-Eyed Raven to another Three-Eyed Raven, it's not that difficult to explain. He could have just said it's a title. But if it's also Bran in the tree at a later point in his life after traveling backwards through time, then it does become a little bit more difficult to explain. So I compiled some quotes from the books for you guys to sort of illuminate the evidence for this theory and why people have speculated this. The first quote comes from A Game of Thrones, chapter 24, Bran's fourth chapter.
"I could tell you the story about Brandon the Builder," old Nan said. "That was always your favorite."
Thousands and thousands of years ago, Brandon the Builder had raised Winterfell, and some said the Wall. Bran knew the story, but it had never been his favorite. Maybe one of the other Brandons had liked that story. Sometimes Nan would talk to him as if he were her Brandon, the baby she had nursed all those years ago, and sometimes she confused him with his uncle Brandon, who was killed by the Mad King before Bran was even born. She had lived so long, Mother had told him once, that all the Brandon Starks had become one person in her head. So that's a pretty interesting quote. All the Brandon Starks being one person. Maybe Bran is all those Brandon Starks. Another little interesting passage talks about how Bran knows more about Winterfell, even at 7 years old, than anybody else. It's from A Game of Thrones, Chapter 8, Bran 2. "To a boy, Winterfell was a gray stone labyrinth of walls and towers and courtyards and tunnels spreading out in all directions. In the older parts of the castle, the halls slanted up and down so that you couldn't even be sure what floor you were on. The place had grown over the centuries like some monstrous stone tree, Maester Lewin told him once. Its branches were gnarled and thick and twisted, its roots sunk deep into the earth. When he got out from under it and scrambled up near the sky, Bran could see all of Winterfell at a glance. He liked the way it looked, spread out beneath him, only birds wheeling over his head while all the life of the castle went on below. Bran could perch for hours among the shapeless, rain-worn gargoyles that brooded over the first keep, watching it all. The men drilling with wood and steel in the yard, the cooks tending their vegetables in the glass garden, restless dogs running back and forth in the kennels, the silence of the godswood. The girls gossiping beside the washing well. It made him feel like he was lord of the castle, in a way even Rob would never know. It taught him Winterfell's secrets, too. The builders had not even leveled the earth. There were hills and valleys behind the walls of Winterfell. There was a covered bridge that went from the fourth floor of the bell tower across to the second floor of the rookery. Bran knew about that. And he knew you could get inside the inner wall by the south gate, climb three floors, and run all the way around Winterfell through a narrow tunnel in the stone, and then come out on the ground level at the north gate, with 100 feet of wall looming over you. Even Maester Lewin didn't know about that, Bran was convinced. So Bran seems to know this castle very, very well. In Game of Thrones Chapter 14, Catelyn 3, it says, "The boy had always been sure-handed in the past," Maester Lewin said thoughtfully. "He knew every stone in Winterfell." So Bran would know every stone in Winterfell if he had placed every stone in Winterfell as Brandon the Builder. Just subtle little hints like that. We are also told that a child instructed this guy Durin in the building of Storm's End, which is the Baratheon house seat. In A Clash of Kings, Chapter 31, Catelyn 3, it says, "Five more castles he built, each larger and stronger than the last, only to see them smashed asunder when the gale winds came howling up Shipbreaker Bay, driving great walls of water before them. His lords pleaded with him to build inland. His priests told him he must placate the gods by giving Elenai back to the sea. Even his small folk begged him to relent. Durin would have none of it. A seventh castle he raised, most massive of all. Some said the children of the forest helped him build it, shaping the stones with magic. Others claimed that a small boy had told him what he must do, a boy who would grow to be Bran the Builder. No matter how the tale was told, the end was the same. Though the angry gods threw storm after storm against it, the seventh castle stood defiant, and Durin Godsgrief and fair Elenai dwelt there together until the end of their days." If Storm's End was built with magic that came from the children of the forest, Bran would have access to these magics, all those magics needed for the construction of the wall and Storm's End, etc. As we find out in A Dance with Dragons, Chapter 34, Bran 3, "A reader lives 1,000 lives before he dies," said Jojen. "The man who never reads only lives one. The singers of the forest had no books, no ink, no parchment, no written language. Instead, they had the trees, and the weirwoods above all. When they died, they went into the wood, into leaf and limb and root, and the trees remembered. All their songs and spells, their histories and prayers, everything they knew about the world. Maesters will tell you that the weirwoods are sacred to the old gods. The singers believe they are the old gods. When singers die, they become part of that godhood." So now, since Bran is tapped into this weirwood network, he would have access to all these spells and magic things, you know, that the children of the forest were practicing back in the day. All this sacred knowledge would now be in Bran's head if these people and entities were in fact assimilated into the weirwood network upon death. So this story with Durin Godsgrief building the Storm's End castle with the help of magic from the children of the forest at the instruction of a small boy makes perfect sense if that small boy is Bran Stark, who would later be Bran the Builder, and he's informing Durin Godsgrief how to use magic that he learned from the Weirwood Network, magic from the children of the forest. In A Game of Thrones, Ned tells Arya that Bran may one day build castles like Bran the Builder or sail the Sunset Sea. without explicitly mentioning that Brandon Stark, the shipwright, had sailed the Sunset Sea. In A Game of Thrones, Chapter 25, Eddard V. No, Ned said. He saw no use in lying to her. Yet some day he may be the lord of a great holdfast and sit on the king's council. He might raise castles like Brandon the Builder, or sail a ship across the Sunset Sea, or enter your mother's faith and become the High Septon. But he will never run beside his wolf again, he thought with a sadness too deep for words, or lie with a woman, or hold his own son in his arms. So there we have Ned saying that Brandon or Bran may do these things that are attributed to other great Brandon Starks. Just all little hints that Bran has an important future, that he's going to be doing something on a massive scale, something cool, something unique. In last week's episode, Bran was having a vision as he approached the wall. And the interesting thing about this was that he wasn't even touching any weirwoods. Yet he's having a vision of the White Walkers traveling south. Interestingly, there's this thing that's going on in the books where while Bran is inside the cave, he's being fed this paste that the fan base refers to as Jojen paste. And it's speculated that Bran is essentially, without knowing it, cannibalizing the body of Jojen, that they're feeding Bran Jojen mixed up in this paste combined with weirwood roots and whatnot. But given the context of last week's episode where he's having visions without touching any weirwood trees, this paste may have a different significance. Maybe if Bran has been ingesting weirwood, it's possible that he doesn't need to touch the weirwood trees because now he has weirwood built into his own physiology, that there's weirwood roots inside his blood, inside his body that he can tap into so he can access this network from anywhere, which is a pretty cool idea. In A Dance with Dragons, Chapter 34, Bran 3, it says, "The singers carved eyes into their heart trees to awaken them, and those are the first eyes a new green seer learns to use. But in time, you will see well beyond the trees themselves." This refers to the three-eyed raven being able to look through the eyes of other animals and whatnot. 1,000 eyes in 1, they said about Blood Raven in the book. But perhaps it also references Bran's ability to access the network from anywhere beyond the trees themselves. So that's pretty cool. There are other hints of Bran being eternal, like when Theon seems to see his face carved in the weirwood tree in Winterfell. And that's significant because these faces have been carved there for thousands of years. The weirwood trees live basically forever, so they're sort of like these eternal beings. And seeing Bran's face on one may have implications towards that direction for him. So in A Dance with Dragons, Chapter 46, The Ghost in Winterfell, it says this, "The night was windless, the snow drifting straight down out of a cold black sky, yet the leaves of the heart tree were rustling his name. Theon, they seemed to whisper. Theon. The old gods, he thought. They know me. They know my name. I was Theon of House Greyjoy. I was ward of Eddard Stark, a friend and brother to his children. Please, he fell to his knees. A sword, that's all I ask. Let me die as Theon, not as Reek. Tears trickled down his cheeks, impossibly warm. I was Ironborn, a son of Pike, of the Islands. A leaf drifted down from above, brushed his brow, and landed in the pool. It floated on the water, red, five-fingered, like a bloody hand. Bran, the tree murmured. They know, the gods know. They saw what I did, and for one strange moment it seemed as if it were Bran's face carved into the pale trunk of the weirwood, staring down at him with eyes red and wise and sad. Bran's ghost, he thought, but that was madness. Why should Bran want to haunt him? He had been fond of the boy, had never done him any harm. It was not Bran we killed. It was not Rickon. They were only miller's sons from the mill by the Acorn Water. I had to have two heads, else they would have mocked me, laughed at me. They..." A voice said, "Who are you talking to?" Theon spun, terrified that Ramsay had found him, but it was just the washerwomen, Holly, Rowan, and one whose name he did not know. "The ghosts," he blurted. "They whisper to me. They know my name." So there we have Theon seeing Bran's face in the place of this otherwise eternal being, this tree, which is pretty neat. So there are lots of hints that this could be a reality. And Bran did not do anything to detract from those this episode by saying that he both was taught by and is the Three-Eyed Raven himself. Our next interesting book crossover, or potential book crossover in this case, is the fact that Olenna admits to Jaime that she was the one that killed Joffrey before she dies. Now, this would be particularly interesting to me if it happened in the books, because Jaime at this point is actually under the impression that Tyrion did kill Joffrey. As you guys remember, when Jaime frees Tyrion from his cell after he's imprisoned, during his trial, Jaime admits to Tyrion, he frees him and says, Lannister pays his debts. And Tyrion says, what debts? So you don't owe me anything. To which Jaime answers that he basically has been living a lie, and that Tyrion's first wife, Tysha, was never the whore that he claimed she had been. This drives Tyrion crazy and makes him fly off the handle, at which point he falsely admits to murdering Joffrey. He calls Joffrey Jaime's vile bastard or something like that and gloats about having murdered him, which isn't even the case. So in the books, Jaime is really, really fucking pissed at Tyrion, basically, and Tyrion is also really pissed at Jaime for lying to him about his first wife, Tysha. So it would be very interesting to see how Jaime learning this would affect the dynamic, or the potential dynamic, of a reunion between Jaime and Tyrion. It would at least give the potential for Jaime to want to extend an olive branch and reconcile with Tyrion, which I'm hoping happens. And the potential of a reconcile would give Jaime an out in having to deal with Cersei. As we mentioned beforehand in the books, Jaime is obviously less into Cersei. He seems to have fallen out of love with her quite a bit. He sees the Mad King in her and her potential for madness after her, after her incidents with fire and the way she behaves and everything. So it could lead to, in the books, Jaime abandoning Cersei and trying to team up with Tyrion, who he's always had a fondness for, which would be a nice reunion and a good step towards redemption for Jaime as well. And the last thing that I wanted to talk about isn't really a book crossover, but it's just something that I found interesting about this. And it's the irony of the downfall of House Tyrell. So Cersei, obviously, is behind the downfall of this entire house. She armed the Faith Militant, got Ser Loras locked up, got Margaery locked up, had basically, which resulted in their deaths as she blew up the Sept of Baelor. She now has invaded Highgarden and has Jaime poisoned Lady Olenna. And this is all because of Cersei's obsession with the prophecy of Maggie the Frog, who told her that, she would have three children, gold will be their crowns, gold will be their shrouds, a younger, more beautiful queen will come and take everything that you hold dear, seizing power, and her threat, or her prophecy of the Valonqar strangling the life out of her. So, basically, Cersei's been obsessed with this prophecy, and her interpretation had placed Queen Margaery in the role of the younger, more beautiful queen. So because of this, Cersei has had sort of an obsession with derailing Margaery and weakening and destroying House Tyrell, which is a really, really bad strategic move on her part. Tywin had even said that they needed the Tyrells as an ally. Tyrells have money, they have food, they're respected and loved. A Tyrell-Lannister alliance would be a very, very powerful force to overcome. So if Cersei hadn't been obsessed with this prophecy, she could have married Joffrey or Tommen to Margaery and created a monstrous, powerful alliance between these families that would have resulted in a dynasty that could have lasted 1,000 years, as she mentioned in the last episode and as Tywin had mentioned to Jaime the first time we saw Tywin on screen, when he's butchering that deer and Jaime comes in to talk to him on the field of battle, and And he's talking about how Jaime needs to become the man that he's supposed, he's destined to be, and that they can form a dynasty to last 1,000 years. So instead, nope, Cersei has destroyed a powerful potential ally for no reason and strengthened her enemy Daenerys by causing Tyrion to flee and end up on Daenerys' side. So basically, I think it's pretty poetic and interesting that Cersei has spent so much time obsessed with this prophecy, but all she's done is basically create a self-fulfilling prophecy by weakening her own strength and eliminating potentially powerful alliances that could have helped her, while paving the way for a younger, beautiful queen, Daenerys, to come through and take over everything, and making her even stronger by alienating her brother, who she believed to be the Valonqar, who is destined to murder her. But she jailed him, convinced that he murdered her son, Joffrey, when it was in fact Olenna Tyrell, and created an even more strong enemy by turning Tyrion completely against her. So just pretty ridiculous that Cersei has done this and put herself in this horrible position. I mean, right now, with Euron destroying the fleets that were under Daenerys's control and everything like that, it's pretty bad news for Daenerys, but I don't think any of us expect Daenerys to end up losing to Cersei. That would be an interesting twist if Cersei won the war of the kings and queens, basically, and ended up on top. That would be a pretty shocking twist. I've heard speculation that, you know, people have said that most of the people that Jon has kneeled to have ended up dying. So if for some reason he kneeled to Daenerys, whether to offer fealty or whether as a suitor, it could result in Dany dying. And if Cersei took over, that would be pretty ridiculous. But I wouldn't put it past George R. Martin. George R. R. Martin. Anyway, that's it for today's Still Smug Book Talk. I hope you guys enjoyed learning some details from the books. This is Sir Duncan signing off. Thanks, everybody, and Valar Morghulis.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.